What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. As shared in part one of her story, Amanda is a mother, mental health compliance professional, and advocate. Nearly 20 years ago, Amanda was employed by a fixture in the family court whose deviousness would be unearthed in 2007 when he faced charges for alleged voyeurism. Her experiences surviving professional abuse, sexual harassment, and suspected voyeurism at the hands of this renowned forensic psychologist have been motivation in Amanda's mission to ensure the mental health industry fosters safety and wellness. In this episode, Amanda bravely shares what she was subjected to within the walls of this psychologist's office and what came next within her healing journey after freeing herself of the abuse. The Broken Cycle Media team is so grateful for Amanda's time, energy, professional perspective, and the awareness about professional abuse she's cultivating today and within her work.
When Dr. Greenberg left to go out of state, because he was also licensed in, I think, Alaska and Indiana, of all places, we all that worked there, we kind of let our hair down. It was nice not to have him there. We would joke, do you think he's listening in on us? Because suffice to say, we didn't work around the clock when he was gone. It was nice just to hang out and take a longer lunch, those type of things. In hindsight, I'm like, holy shit, I think he probably was listening to us and recording us. There was one bathroom in this tiny office. I remember this happening to both myself and to some of my colleagues. He would be in the bathroom using it, and he would knock on the door and carry on a conversation. Say, Amanda, do you know where XYZ file is? And it was like, I'm in the restroom. How inappropriate. I also recall he would send me, but he also sent other colleagues right next door to his house to do menial tasks. It was this multi-story house, big, and he would give very convoluted instructions and directions on where to find said items. I need a file. It's on the south end side of the kitchen next to this drawer. If you turn around, it's right there. Can you go over and get it? Which seems innocent and harmless, but I would go over there, not find it, go back over, and I would say, I don't see it. He would act like I was stupid and say, well, did you check the west side of the northeast corner of whatever office? Okay, I'll go back over there and find it. And I would never be able to find it. In retrospect, knowing what I know now, I truly feel like that was his way of filming me or filming us. Why would he have us go into his house and do these convoluted treasure hunts to find an item that we could never find? In those moments, I felt stuck. I had put all my eggs in the basket that this would be an experience that would solidify my trajectory into the field of clinical psychology. I also think now, in retrospect, I know I was probably disconnected and numb, because it does parallel with my childhood and the abuse I experienced from my sibling, where I couldn't ask for help. I needed to be in control and handle the situation myself. So I put up with it. I also didn't have the tools, both emotionally and professionally, to recognize what was happening and to know that I could have just left and it would have been okay. I worked there for about a year and a half, and then my husband's work relocated us to Portland. And in that time, I hadn't nailed down another job in Portland. So I did provide as needed work for Dr. Greenberg. I would live with a friend temporarily up in Seattle, come into his office and do some work, and then go back home on the weekends. I did that for another 6 months or so as I began to nail down another job in Portland. And amongst all this, I was unsure if I wanted to continue working toward a doctorate degree in clinical psychology, not just because of the cost, but also because in my time with Dr. Greenberg, I really started to see fractures, not just in Dr. Greenberg's work, but also in the world of psychology. I also was experiencing secondary trauma from that work as well, sitting through these interviews, reading people's documents and diaries, trying to process that. Dr. Greenberg did not provide any form of debriefing for me or for any other colleagues who worked at his office. I was left to process that on my own. And at that point, I decided I was not going to continue my studies, which also gave me another reason why to leave. I didn't need to hang on to, well, he's a great reference. He made every attempt to get me to stay. I recall him saying, well, why don't you just stay here in Seattle with me during the week? We have a spare bedroom in our house. Even our office manager was like, let her go. She's not going to stay. She needs to move on. I was so disgusted by his behavior at that point that I think I just would have left and not even said anything. I had been living in Portland for about a year, but had stopped working for Dr. Greenberg in any capacity. My husband, who was friends with a gentleman who did maintenance for a lot of Dr. Greenberg's property, including his own home, he called my husband in July 2007 and said he had gone into Dr. Greenberg's personal home and had noticed that there was a VCR attached to a large, newer big screen TV. He knew right away that that seemed unusual. This was a man that had a lot of means. Why would he have a VCR hooked up to a big screen TV? It didn't really make sense. He pushed the play button, and from what I understand, a live feed of the bathroom in the office next door popped up. There had already been discussions that there was an air freshener in the bathroom that seemed out of place, that didn't work. Somebody at the office had turned the air freshener around. This is before the VCR was found. And apparently, Dr. Greenberg left his private residence, marched right over to the office, went into the bathroom, turned the air freshener around, and then left. So that was weird. And I think it was within a matter of hours or a day that this VCR was found. From there, it was reported to the police. They responded. Dr. Greenberg was arrested, charged, and held for voyeurism. Early July 2007, when I'd heard this news, I reached out to the Seattle police and said, I just want to know, am I on any of these videos? I sent a copy of my photo ID to them. I remember the police officer saying, we cannot tell you if you are or not in any of this. I was in his office 3 months prior. I was concerned about pictures. Photos were found that were clearly voyeuristic pictures. I'm assuming Dr. Greenberg had taken from a window in his house, looking straight down a woman's shirt. To this day, just by anatomy, I think that was me that he had taken those pictures of. They had searched his home. Apparently there had been time that passed between his arrest, when he posted bail, and then when they searched his home. So he could have disposed of a lot of things. There was no proof that I was ever filmed. But my gut does tell me that there were pictures, there were videos of me in some capacity in his possession. If the Seattle police had said, yes, we have these pictures and videos, I think the only way I would have felt more violated is the thought of other people seeing it too. But I don't think it would have changed anything. I've even thought, let's say I was able to jump on the civil suit, would I have done that? I don't know if I would have sought financial repercussion or damages from him and his estate. I wouldn't have wanted to go through that trauma again. And I also wouldn't want to have known where he recorded me. And he recorded clients in the bathroom too. I can't even fathom how somebody who is in a very stressful, critical time in their life, how that can compound in those situations where he clearly was excited by the description of some of these circumstances that these women were expressing in interview. These were all, from my perception, very intelligent, aware women. And how they felt walking out of that office as a married woman with two children now, I can't even fathom being in their shoes. And then you compound potentially being recorded in the bathroom. At the end of July, the same gentleman who had found the video called my husband and said that Dr. Greenberg took his own life. Reports say that he took some medication in a hotel room and left the housekeepers to find him. In between the time where he was arrested and charged and when he took his own life, from what I understand, he resigned from the University of Washington. He had his license revoked from the state regulation board. So there certainly were some immediate consequences. His private practice was shut down immediately just by knowing him and his personality. I don't think he felt shame. I think he felt embarrassed and knew that his career was over. I do not think he thought about how his actions affected many, many people, not just his staff and people who worked for him, but in the professional world, the people that paid him to do a job well and to be transparent. I really do not think he felt that he had done them any harm. It was really all about him. It was shocking, but not that shocking. We knew that he was a bad man, but talking amongst some of my colleagues, there was a lot of fear that we could get pulled in to some of the suits that were being filed by his victims that were clients. Because we had been there, because our names were on documents. So there was certainly that level of fear in trying to get that sorted out. I know some colleagues did hire their own attorneys to protect them, but also to try to seek out as much damage control as they could. So it was just a very scary time. I did seek therapy for myself to try to navigate this. The therapist that I worked with was absolutely shocked. She had never heard of a story like this before, but I did some work through therapy to help me process and heal. I learned through that I have the right to be treated with respect, and I have the right to prioritize my own needs, not just in my home life, but also in my professional life. And I've really carried that with me from this experience. I love to do research and seek out resources myself. So I did a lot of reading about setting boundaries professionally and learning some scripts around being able to say no and feeling confident in that being a complete sentence. There's a book about the art of saying no. I don't recall who wrote that, but that's a good one. Another one that isn't about professional abuse, but it's about sibling abuse. And from my experience, those two really paralleled each other. It's a book called Madhouse growing up in the shadow of a mentally ill sibling. That worked for me as a tool because I could see how what I experienced in Dr. Greenberg's office and his behavior was very similar to what I experienced with my sibling in my childhood. I also did some exploration to see truly how adoption has affected me and that need to be the perfect child. That's what I did at Dr. Greenberg's office. I also really built upon my professional development in the world of mental health, which opened my eyes to being able to identify when these things happen or signs of malfeasance in mental health. I do know that he had his license suspended in either the 80s or 90s. There was some cases filed against him. For whatever reason, he was able to skirt the ramifications and continue operating in a practice. There was an article in 2018 that I found that talks about this, even just in the Seattle area. The number of clinicians and professors in psychology that had these backgrounds and were able to hide them or skirt around everything and still practice. I don't want to say it's common, but it's more frequent than people know about, unfortunately. It also built up my confidence to push back in the professional setting and ask questions. It was really about self-improvement and self-development and building confidence. Now, having been in the world of mental health and social services for as long as I have, I don't skip a beat just by saying, hey, wait a minute, time out. Something about this doesn't seem right. And here is why. I did pivot my degree from clinical psychology into a master's degree in organizational development with an emphasis on data and statistics, which is really more what I enjoy doing. Now I've shifted my role to compliance in the mental health world. I find it very important to have oversight and transparency in mental health, to know that other people have eyes on what is going on behind the closed therapeutic door. I did not want somebody to look at me as if I knew what was wrong and that I could offer something that could, quote, fix them. That was too much responsibility. For anybody who's entering this world of mental health, that if the culture of the place that you're working at does not feel right, plan an exit strategy. There's certainly no rule book for this type of abuse. If you're in a position where you are being professionally abused, my number one tip would be to document, document, document. I would say report that and keep record that you're reporting it. If you cannot report it directly to an HR or employee relations department, because some smaller practices don't have that, research what boards you can report to. There are oversight boards and regulatory boards. Know who you can report to and do that. Definitely start building an exit, both figuratively and literally. I felt in moments at Dr. Greenberg's office that I needed to know physically how I could exit that office through the back door or the front door as quickly as possible. I kept that at the forefront of my mind and never put myself the best I could in a situation where he and I were alone or he would be able to back me into a corner. And then literally building an exit plan to network with other mental health professionals to try to leave for another agency if possible, and looking for another workplace that is very trauma-informed, because I had some undoing when I went from Dr. Greenberg's office into another role. I have landed in a position where it's a very trauma-informed environment and a very respectful environment. Everyone is treated in a way that we all have different areas of expertise, but nobody has to be the expert in everything. I went to an agency where I was transparent about what I had just experienced. And I had a boss who understood that. He himself was a mental health professional and was okay with me asking, do I need to do this? There should never be one expert. I think that family court needs to be transparent. There needs to be integrity and accountability for that. There needs to be compliance experts who come in and take a really in-depth look at what is going on. The best interest of the child, of the family, of the situation is where there are third-party review boards, and that can be made up of citizens. It can be made up of individuals who've gone through the process before, of professionals that don't have any relationship with the agency. I also think there needs to be more information provided to really anybody who is involved in the family court system about the process in a trauma-informed way that is also in their preferred language, in simplified language, that gives them a clear understanding of what it is that they'll be going through or what they could experience, and also how they file a complaint or grievance. They can file that in their preferred language. It needs to be accessible to them so that they have a voice and have some power in the situation. I have to reference rules and regulations and statutes to understand what's going on. I can't imagine how somebody who is in a situation where they might be losing their child, or it's a child who is trying to find out what is going to happen to them, is expected to do that same work that I do as a professional that I can barely make sense of.
Thank you for your perspective, for your expertise, for being very raw, vulnerable, and sharing your trajectory.
Thank you. It was so good to talk to you. I'm glad I'm able to tell the story. I never would have thought that almost 20 years later, it would still be relevant, but I feel like it's very, very relevant still.
Voyeurism is the act of watching other people engaged in behaviors of a private nature and is currently criminalized at the state level in 12 U.S. states. The crime is deemed both a misdemeanor and felony, dependent upon the state, the severity of the crime, and/or the prior criminal history of the perpetrator. Video-based voyeurism is a federal criminal offense and includes using a recording device to capture intimate images or videos of someone without their consent, with the intent of experiencing sexual gratification, and in a situation in which the victim has a reasonable expectation of having privacy. Video voyeurism became a federal offense by the passing of the Video Voyeurism Prevention Act of 2004, which came about as a result of increased camera use and technology. However, as news station WPRI of Rhode Island highlights in a 2018 article, only 3 people charged with video voyeurism in Rhode Island have served any prison time related to their video voyeurism charges, since the law targeting it was enacted in 2004. As the article states, there were 56 video voyeurism cases in Rhode Island in the 14 years since the Prevention Act was passed, resulting in 33 convictions or no contest pleas, 10 cases dismissed or not indicted, and 13 cases that remain open. Of the 33 convictions, though, only 3 served prison time for their crime of voyeurism. WPRI reports that the wording of the law, which states that the crime must be executed for the purpose of sexual arousal, gratification, or stimulation, remains hard to prove in most cases. According to the medical resource, the Merck Manual, approximately 12% of males and 4% of females reported at least one episode of voyeuristic behavior in their lifetime. Various studies show the ratio of male to female voyeurs to be 2-to-1 to 3-to-1. The Merck Manual goes on to explain that people with voyeuristic disorder studied in prison settings, may have comorbid hypersexuality, exhibitionistic disorder, depression, conduct disorder, or antisocial personality disorder. To hear more about the current climate of the family court system in America, please consider listening to What Came Next, episode 21, entitled Tina Swithin, One Mom's Battle. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
Programs across the country are facing cuts to the VOCA Act, VOCA's Victims of Crime Act, and it is a major funder for program services for rape crisis centers, domestic violence shelters all across the country. Pretty much across the board, everyone is facing major, major cuts.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.